And there's another expression in the black community, and that is when white America gets a cold, African Americans get pneumonia. And that is the disparity that we're seeing right now in real time. You've got layer upon layer upon layer of contributing factors. Those layers, they're falling away and they're exposing the very real structural bias that's built in to healthcare in the United States.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed many inequities in U.S. healthcare, not the least of which is racial. According to data released in the last week, an estimated 70% of reported COVID-19 deaths in Louisiana and Chicago were among African Americans, who only count for about 30% of the population in each area. In New York City, still a hot zone for the outbreak, the death rate among Hispanics and African Americans is around twice that of its white citizens. As the United States continues to struggle against the deadly virus, what are the factors leading to these disturbing numbers? Are they biologic, cultural, economic? And what does government and society as a whole need to do to protect the lives of all its citizens during the crisis? Hello, I'm Anand Naidu. Welcome to the Heat Podcast. With us to talk about the racial health disparities in the United States is Joseph P. Williams. He's a senior editor at U.S. News & World Report and writes for their Healthiest Communities section. His April 7th article focuses on how black people are disproportionately getting and dying from COVID-19. He joins us via Skype. Joseph, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
Looking at these racial disparities in the United States healthcare system, they existed long before COVID-19. What are some of the chronic factors in African-American communities that contribute to these infection numbers that we're seeing?
Well, I mean, how much time do you have? I mean, there are a host of factors, not the least of which, as you mentioned, health disparities. There are a lot of disproportionate chronic illnesses that are found in African-American communities at far higher rates than whites. And we're talking about diabetes. We're talking about high blood pressure, hypertension, cancer, a host of illnesses that tend to surface in African-Americans more than whites. And on top of that, you have socioeconomic factors, not the least of which being employment. African-Americans tend to have jobs that don't necessarily grant medical leave. There's a lot of people who work in public-facing jobs. Think retail, think restaurants, think bus drivers, think transit. A number of African-Americans who have jobs that don't allow to work from home because of the aforementioned factors. They have to be present in order to get the job, and you have to be on the job in order to get a paycheck because many of these jobs don't necessarily carry with them medical leave. So that's layered on top of already existing health issues. And on top of that is an issue that not a lot of people talk about, which is how the medical community, how the medical industry sometimes discriminates implicitly against African Americans. There's been study after study that talk about how doctors don't necessarily take symptoms as seriously from African Americans as they do from whites, how pain management is different between white doctors and black patients, how African Americans are afraid sometimes or anxious about the treatment that they'll get from white doctors. So you've got layer upon layer upon layer of contributing factors. And what we have here is those layers, they're falling away and they're exposing the very real structural bias that's built in to healthcare in the United States.
So the reported infections among African Americans and other minorities are huge compared to that of the white population. But that's just in what we know right now, reported cases. If we look at the actual rate, could it be much higher? Because testing has not been optimal.
Testing has been far from optimal for everyone. The United States still doesn't know exactly what extent the virus is taking hold here in this country because we don't have enough testing kits. We have a very serious problem in not knowing how many African Americans are falling victim to this disease and how many have died because many states aren't keeping track of that data categorized by race. And in order to figure out what's going on, we need to get a broad picture, and that broad picture only comes through information. For some reason, the CDC has been very, very reluctant to categorize by race. Several states, same thing. New York only recently released data categorized by race. Washington, D.C., the African-American mayor here, has kind of swept aside the issue by saying all deaths matter, which is not really the point. The point is you have a disproportionate number of people who are dying, and we need to figure out why. You can't define the problem or begin to address it until you know how large and how substantial that problem is. And that's where data comes into play and why it's so important.
Clearly, Joseph, if we look at the response right now, and we see these numbers, 70% in many cases of people being infected are African-American. The response right now has not changed in any way, has it?
It has not. One of significant factors here is that the government has been very, very slow-footed in responding to this crisis. The government writ large. We haven't even talked about some of the states that have not issued shelter-in-place orders. Some of the states like Missouri, like Alabama, Mississippi, states with heavy concentrations of African Americans. It was shocking this morning when I saw headlines out of St. Louis, Missouri, where the entirety of the COVID-19 patients, the COVID-19 fatalities, were African American. So you've got a disproportionate and uneven response on the federal level, where the U.S. government did not issue broad guidelines for states to follow. You have individual states making up what they're doing on an ad hoc basis. You have a lack of data collection, which eliminates one factor that we could use to kind of examine where the problem is and what the scope of it is. And you've got a lack of testing everywhere, which is another factor in figuring out how big this problem is, who is spreading the problem, and how to get a handle on it so we can contain the fatality rate and bring this problem to heel.
Your article focused on African Americans, but do you see a similar sort of situation among poor whites, low-income whites? I mean, I was wondering how much of this has to do with economic class.
Economics is a third layer on top of all the other layers we talked about. And among white Americans, it's serious in Appalachia, in the coal countries of West Virginia. The difference there is you don't have that layer of implicit bias in the medical system. You do, however, have problems with transportation in getting to and from the doctor. Not too long ago, I was down in Mississippi doing some reporting there on health, and their federally qualified healthcare clinics are threadbare right now. You have several rural hospitals that have closed. You have clinics that are overstretched, can't get federal aid, and can't get the federal medicines that they need. And these are where a large proportion of African Americans and whites are living. So economics is a significant factor on this. It can't be discounted. But the racial factor and the distrust that African Americans feel in the healthcare system is something that whites would not necessarily succumb to and wouldn't necessarily be a factor in driving up those rates.
In recent years, there's been a lot of focus on racial bias in the healthcare system, and in turn, there's been a general mistrust about healthcare among minority communities. Can you explain that?
Certainly. Back in the 1940s, the most obvious example is the Tuskegee experiment. That's where the government allowed African-American men to contract syphilis, and it led to a whole generation of people being mistrustful of the medical system. It was an experiment in real time. Then you have the Henrietta Lacks protocol, where an African-American woman who was dying of cervical cancer in the 1950s unknowingly had her cells harvested and replicated in a lab for research and development of drugs and treatments for cervical cancer, cells that are still in use today, I might add. Couple that with formerly segregated hospital wards, with hospitals that would not treat black people, with an African-American who might show up with an emergency might get turned away. So it's been almost built in the medical system's DNA that this legacy has not yet been concretely addressed and hasn't yet been examined closely. So you have that ugly past, and no one has really responded or tried to address it in a real and substantive manner.
Joseph, if we look at the election that's coming up in November, if there is an election that'll take place at that time, healthcare has been one of the major issues that have been talked about so far. Are you surprised that this is not a bigger issue in the kind of healthcare that African Americans can get access to?
It is talked about, but it's also talked about in broad strokes. During the early parts of the Democratic presidential primary, you had several candidates who talked about healthcare. Liz Warren, Bernie Sanders, of course, who recently dropped out, they're no longer in the race. But early on, it was a significant issue. It just wasn't laid out in such racial overtones that we have now. And that's because it was a problem hiding in plain sight. According to Bernie Sanders' approach, a rising tide lifts all boats. But that doesn't do you any good if your boat has a hole in it. And there's another expression in the black community that comes to mind, and that is when white America gets a cold, African Americans get pneumonia. And that is the disparity that we're seeing right now in real time. going forward, we don't even know if we're going to have a presidential election. And certainly the campaign has been truncated, as you mentioned. So it's unclear how much this is going to rise to the top. Certainly a lot of white voters, it's foremost on their minds. It's going to be more of an issue for African Americans going forward. And even if you look no further than the election in Wisconsin that happened on Tuesday, where people were being asked to risk their lives to go vote, either go vote and risk getting coronavirus or stay home and have your vote not counted, it's clear where the directions are lying on the Republican side and where the direction needs to go on the Democratic side.
The other problem I see, and it's something that you talk about in your article, in that, you know, there's been no national response to this in the United States. These 50 states sometimes act like 50 different countries. In your article, you talk about the states that have, quote, turned their back on the Affordable Care Act. That's, of course, the health care laws that were put in place under the previous president, President Obama. Or these states have not even expanded Medicaid, which is the state-run, or at least the federal government-runs healthcare service. I mean, what is the reality of that for people living in these communities that we've been talking about?
This is where the chickens of Medicare expansion are coming home to roost. Mississippi, again, was among them, and their community healthcare system is in tatters. There are counties, entire jurisdictions with no doctors. There are entire jurisdictions where hospitals have shut down, where clinics are struggling. So this is the bad wind that's blowing off that decision. It's easy to discount medical care in good times and when you're not the person who needs to go see a doctor. But if your health is on the line and you can't get to see a doctor, you're going to have to trace that decision back to your governor's decision to not accept federal money to broaden healthcare access. So it's really unfortunate, but a lot of experts predicted that this day would come, that there would be a catastrophe, there'd be a pandemic, and the decision to not accept federal money will cost people their lives.
As you say, that day has now arrived. Do you expect things to change?
It's difficult to say. I mean, not the least of which is because a lot of this is systemic, but very much more of it is political. You have a chain of states, ironically and tragically, where 13% of the African-American population lives. We're talking Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Northern Florida, North Carolina, and South Carolina. Those are a chain of Republican-led states that refuse to take the Affordable Care Act as an option. It's where a large number of African-Americans live. It's also where a large number of poor whites live. But for some reason, it has been really difficult to mobilize and get people to reject the political leadership that would reject something like Obamacare. So you have a big picture, which is that there is a crying need for some kind of coordinated response. And on top of that, once the pandemic is over, some kind of national structure for healthcare and the small picture response, which is you have very many states that have been Republican. They've been red states for a long time. And it's very difficult because of structures and different laws to overturn that power structure. So nothing will happen on the large level until the smaller level understands that this is what needs to happen.
Do you know if these kinds of disparities exist in other countries?
It's hard to say. I don't think they do, mostly because, and this is just simply a theory, a lot of countries are more homogeneous, both culturally and politically in terms of their population. You look at a country like South Korea, who were very much on the spot in testing for these diseases. They were able to get out in front of it quite a bit, quite quickly, because they understand, having gone through the avian flu. Now, you could also factor in a place like Iran, which you would seem to meet that criteria, but they had an awful response. But you don't necessarily see the disparity in health there, because a lot of countries, other than the United States, a lot of Western countries, have government-subsidized or government-run healthcare, and that tends to tamp down a lot of the disparities.
Why isn't this a bigger issue in the halls of power in Congress, Joseph? I mean, we have people there like Jim Clyburn, we have people like John Lewis, we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or the Squad as they're known, those four Congress people there. Why isn't this? Why are they making an issue of this?
They are making an issue. Ocasio-Cortez, in fact, was very much on the Bernie Sanders bandwagon as far as nationalized healthcare was concerned. The problem that you identified is all those members that you talked about who are fairly progressive, who see the big picture, they're in the House, which is proportionate to representation. In other words, in the House, you have a lot more minorities, you have a lot more people representing those kinds of interests because you're representing a broader section of the country. In the Senate, however, that's where a lot of these healthcare bills, these movements to go fund healthcare, that's where they go to die, because you have two senators for every state. And that means a small population state like Rhode Island gets the same amount of representation as a large population state like California. Scattered in between, you have the red states that I was talking about. Two members for each one of those states, even though their populations are somewhat smaller and less concentrated than larger states. So that creates the imbalance that kills a lot of these bills, because you have Republicans in charge in the Senate and you have Democrats who are in the majority in the House. They can advance a progressive bill that the Republicans will either refuse to pass or not take up at all. And furthermore, if the Democrats somehow end up in power in the Senate, there still is enough Republican representation for a filibuster. So there's kind of unequal balance of power, and that's a lot of the reason why not many of these proposals have gotten off the ground.
And to what extent are these inequities being driven by the fact that the country's main system for healthcare is a private, for-profit system?
Some would argue that that's the only reason why these disparities occur, because there is no incentive for them not to occur. Now, after having said that, a lot of healthcare companies are seeing it in their best interest to promote broad health for everybody, but it is not in their financial interest to hand over control to the federal government. That was one of the reasons why Obamacare was reasonably successful with the private sector, is that they still got to have control. They still got to exist in the marketplace. It seems like they would not exist. A lot of people are suggesting that they would not exist or should not exist if we have universal health care.
So you say if this has to change, it has to change at the local level. How will that take place?
The big picture is that it's been made much harder by different laws in red states that curb or curtail voting registration and voter participation in the name of preventing fraud. So when Republicans had the majority in a lot of these states, they were very good and very efficient about changing districts, about changing voting laws. So that's one hurdle. The second hurdle is organization, in that you have a lot of people with disparate interests and a lot of people who don't necessarily agree. They're not going to go in lockstep like the Republican Party might. So organization is key. Organization will have to happen in order to get some of these laws overturned. And once those laws are overturned or adjusted and voting is expanded, then you might see more real, legitimate, substantial change.
Joseph, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I've been talking to Joseph P. Williams. He's a senior editor at US News and World Report. The Heat is produced by CGTN America. Our executive producer is Atirath H. and the senior producer is John Gilmore. Joshua Barlow produces our podcast. Today's guest producer was Stephen Page, and our director of digital development is Michael Shigori. Once again, I'm Arnand Naidu. Thanks for listening. Do you have a comment or question about today's podcast? Send us an email. You can find us at heatpodcast@cgtnamerica.com. And please, if you like The Heat, help spread the word by subscribing, rating, or leaving a comment with your favorite podcast provider.